from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Timothy Leary, the prominent Harvard psychologist who championed what he believed were the curative powers of hallucinogenic drugs like LSD. Leary became a pop culture icon in the 60s. He urged young people to turn on, tune in, drop out. But the book we're talking about today is not a biography of Leary. In fact, it's about a 28-month period of his life where he's labeled as a revolutionary by the Nixon White House. He's arrested, imprisoned, but escapes and goes on the lam. The stories are crazy. And the book is about Nixon as much as it is Leary. The writers say both men had more in common than they knew. They both saw the truth as cosmically malleable. The book is called The Most Dangerous Man in America. Join us after the news.
We understand that the 24-hour news cycle can be pretty exhausting. At KUER, we push beyond the cycle, challenging our listeners and ourselves to break through the echo chamber, get away from the soundbite. When you tune into KUER, you hear stories that matter to Utah and around the world, stories that put the news in context and broaden your perspective. Please support KUER's Spring Fund Drive. Make your gift at KUER.org, and thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's the setup for the show today. It's the summer of 1971, and President Richard Nixon is freaking out. The opposition to the war in Vietnam is growing. There are demonstrations in the streets and on college campuses. The anguish has inspired militants and radicals, the Weathermen, the Black Panthers. There are explosions, actual explosions and fires in cities around the country. And as Bill Minutaglio and Stephen Davis say in their new book, the president is feeling surrounded by enemies. And what he needs, someone tells him, is a boogeyman, a bad guy, someone who could divert the attention of the American people. And Richard Nixon finds just the person, Timothy Leary, former Harvard professor with a genius IQ who had become known as the godfather of the psychedelic movement of the 1960s. He saw psychotropic drugs as having curative and creative powers. He took LSD, a lot of it, and he told young people unhappy with what was happening in the country to do the same, to turn on, tune in, drop out. Bill Minutaglio's new book is about one part of this story, the time Leary is arrested, imprisoned, and escapes. And Richard Nixon, desperate to keep his boogeyman, goes after him, all over the world, in fact. The book's called The Most Dangerous Man in America. Today in the program, we're talking about it with Bill Minutaglio, who's a journalist and author, recently retired as professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. He co-authored the co-author of 9 books. He wrote The Most Dangerous Man in America with Stephen L. Davis. He's joining us today from KUT in Austin. Bill Minutaglio, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's really, really good to be with you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So where did this idea come from for this book? I mean, it seems like it's something that you'd been you and Stephen Davis maybe had been thinking about for years and years.
Yeah, it was kind of a convergence. Steve had been thinking about Tim Leary, I think, from a distance as an admirer and you know, an object of curiosity and so on. I had actually met Tim, so that was my entry point to the book.
Yeah.
Back in the early 1980s, I spent what I remember, a pretty interesting afternoon with him. It was a 4 or 5 hour conversation in a bar in Houston, Texas, the oldest bar, I think, in the state of Texas. Mm. And we knocked off for the afternoon and had a few cool beverages and just talked. And about everything. I was just simply blown away by his charisma, his intelligence, his vision, even his empathy. But what struck me when I talked to him then was that he was trying to make sense of his own life.
Yeah.
For such a smart man, he had no idea what really had been happening to him. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the circumstances of Richard Nixon, like the great Eye of Sauron in The Lord of the Rings, had been looking out across the country, and as you had aptly identified it, said, let's make Leary sort of public enemy number one. But the long story short is that Tim left me his phone number which I thought was very generous of him. And then I sort of abused the privilege therein. I used to call him over the years, and we'd have these very long, great conversations. And I found him very prescient and visionary. He was talking about how one day a lot of us would be using these portable, small, handheld computers that could also make telephone calls and something called the internet, I think, well before people attributed it to Al Gore. And so that was my entry point. Then Steve and I were talking. We had done a book earlier that was kind of a downer. Mm. Not that there aren't downers in this book, but one that was a pure downer. We wrote a book about the Kennedy assassination. And then when we were through, we were just struck by the thought that we wanted to pursue something else that might marry history, but also the absurdity of history.
Yeah.
And we found our man in Tim Leary.
I have to say that the absurdity of history is apt, an apt description of these stories that play out in this book, because it seems like you're on a drug trip when you read it. It's just so surreal, all the stuff that's going on, one story after the other, one more absurd than the other in some ways. I mean, it was a very strange time in some ways.
Tim was I had in an interview about our book earlier this year, I had referred to him as sort of a cosmic Mr. Magoo, and that might be an old reference, but that was a character, an animated figure when I was growing up, a guy who would open up a door and inadvertently, enter through the portal of history and change world circumstances and sort of rewrite the pages of history. Tim was like that, but at a genius, visionary level. Outsized things seemed to just happen to him in an inordinate degree, from rubbing shoulders with John Lennon. One of the things I like to talk about, because people like to hear it, I think, is the fact that the song "Come Together," obviously the famous Beatles song, was written in large part for Tim Leary by John Lennon. So he just seemed to careen around in this cosmic pinball game of life, and he would meet John Lennon and then meet the great poet Allen Ginsberg, and then wind up in jail, and his cellmate or cell block mate down the road was Charlie Manson.
Yeah.
He was trying to call Keith Richards on the phone. He was trying to get in touch with Mick Jagger at one point to come rescue him when Tim was stranded in Africa.
Yeah.
So
it's extraordinary. But I wanted to get a sense of what you think this is about, just generally speaking, more broadly, because you say in the book that as all of this plays out, as you were writing the book, that there was this one truth that emerged, that Timothy Leary and Richard Nixon had something in common, more than they actually realized, and it was about the truth.
I think they both saw, truth again, as you mentioned so wonderfully, as a malleable enterprise to achieve what I'm sure they were convinced was a noble end. Mm-hmm. I can't even begin to fathom how to explain what Richard Nixon's motivation was in terms of making the truth malleable. I think there have been lots of exploration about that. But as it relates to Tim, I think he thought that his role in life was to try to explain some things to people, but yet more to encourage people to discover the truth on their own, to be eternally curious, and to question. I don't think he would call it fake news, but I think he would say, let's question the existing dogma, just the things that the mainstream folks out there, whether they be in academia, in politics, and maybe even the media. And he had a cool saying. I really liked it. He'd say, he would say to everybody at any age, choose your own major. And there's still time in life to change your major. I think I've changed my major a million times almost based on that advice.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever graduated,
yeah.
But it sounds a lot of, when you talk about Tim, a lot of it sounds quaint and almost, beyond hippie, jargon, but he believed in taking ownership of the truth on your own. And, if you didn't harm someone, but continued a process of exploration and higher consciousness and yes, love, then that will win out in the end.
There's this moment that you tell, it's later in the book, when he is, he happens, as you mentioned, he happened to be imprisoned in Folsom State Prison right next to or near Charles Manson. And they had the opportunity, they couldn't see each other, of course, but they could hear each other. And Manson has a question that he wants to ask Leary.
Right.
And he says to him, Leary, you could have led people anywhere you wanted, but you didn't tell them exactly what to do. And Charles Manson wanted to know why. Would you talk a little bit about that moment? Because I think that's instructive about who Leary was and how he thought about all of this.
Right. By the way, thank you so much. That is at the end of the book. And it's just always a pleasure and an honor to folks who've really, you know, read a work and had the time. And maybe, you know, in my case, drank a lot of coffee to stay awake to get to the end. But
you don't need coffee to keep awake at this thing. It's
okay.
Great.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. But thank you, because that is at the conclusion of the book where, you know, as you said, I'm a little biased in this regard, but as, you know, one door closed in Tim life, another door opened and it was a hurricane. It was, you know, Keith Richards or Andy Warhol, or in this case, Charles Manson on the other side of the threshold. But yeah, in a nutshell, I'm paraphrasing. Tim was in the famous, you know, Folsom Prison from the Johnny Cash song, his iconic and scary prison. And he finds out there's a message coming to him from a guy that he couldn't see, but just sort of just down the row in the row of cells. And you know, Tim, it's me, Charlie. Charlie who? Charles Manson. And Charlie said, I've been waiting to meet you and I wanted to talk to you. And, you know, what's the meaning of life? And why didn't you use your powers, your unbelievable charismatic powers? I had called him, or we called him in the book, the sort of the Robespierre of acid, someone who was really the spiritual and philosophical godfather of the counterculture. He was. He just absolutely was. And Tim, basically, the debate between Manson and Leary boiled down to this, that Manson said, you know, I believe in really the victory of death. And Tim said, well, I believe in the victory of life and love. And we thought it was I suppose that's low-hanging fruit for writers, but we thought, wow, you know, that was quite symbolic and maybe illustrated for us the higher point of the story, that in the early 70s, there was the summer of love had ended and people were drifting off into more of a paranoid form of politics, especially embodied by Richard Nixon. And then this violence as a solution to change – you know, to change the establishment, to end the war through violence, through the bombings and taking the streets and frankly, what might be called domestic terrorism today. Tim didn't believe in any of that. And he, at the very end, right next door to Charles Manson, said the solution, you know, was love.
Yeah. He said, and I'll quote from the book, I didn't want to impose my realities.
Yeah.
The idea is that everybody takes responsibility for his nervous system, creates his own reality.
Yep.
Anything else is brainwashing. Now, what's interesting about that, I think, is that while he didn't believe, he believed in love, he believed in using this passively, but he does get caught up in a revolution, and he even says things, types things, expresses things that seem revolutionary, violent. I mean, there's a moment when he talks about to shoot a genocidal robot policeman in the defense of life is a sacred act. So he seems to get really caught up in all of this. And I wanted you to say something about that, because even as brilliant as he was, as composed and as lucid he could be, even on multiple hits of acid, he seemed to have really been even manipulated in some ways by some of these radicals.
Oh, you know, absolutely. The book, I'm hoping, I'm again heavily biased, I'm hoping is an accurate capture of a man who is subject to forces well beyond his control.
Yeah.
The president of the United States is literally sitting in a room just off the Oval Office with many of the famous, I suppose, infamous members of the Watergate era, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and other advisors. And they've decided that Timothy Leary is going to be public enemy number one in a way to distract Americans, as you said, from this nettlesome war in Vietnam, the rage in the streets, a swooning economy, Nixon's dwindling approval ratings. And then on the other hand, you have the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, the true vanguard of the revolutionary movement, people who believed they were going to overthrow America, spelled with a K, and they were going to topple it. And both parties, both extremes, you know, wanted to use Tim Leary in some way, Nixon to objectify or demonize him. And I maintain, or we maintain in the book, to kickstart sort of the modern day demonization that seems to exist a lot in politics today in America. But then the the underground revolutionaries wanted him too, because they thought that what Tim would do for them was conscript, the hippies, the people who were really still the more passive and pacifist members of the Summer of Love, and maybe Tim would be able to get them out of their meditative poses, off the communes, off the collectives, and then to join the revolution, to take up arms. And so Tim found himself in the middle. So somebody had dubbed it the marriage of dope and dynamite.
Yeah.
Dope and dynamite, that Tim represented the sort of the dope faction in a way, and that he would be linked up with the folks who were crafting bombs, plotting, you know, revolution, really thought they could topple Nixon.
It's interesting that July 23rd, 1971 cabinet room story that you tell in the book.
Right.
They conceived of a boogeyman. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I think it was John Connally, the former governor of Texas, we need a bad guy. And Nixon is all in. And they all begin. It sounds like this strange moment when everyone is sort of chattering and excitedly come to the idea, Timothy Leary is our guy.
Yeah. My wife suggested that I might need some sort of cult deprogramming because I was sitting in my my little tidy home office here in Austin, Texas, listening to hours, days and days on end of Nixon White House tapes. And that's hardly a political statement. I think it could have been any president that would have caused me to look a little cross-eyed when I came out of my office. But I was listening, one day. And just on the hunt for a connection. That seemed at the outset of our working on our book, we hadn't really nailed down this Nixon versus Leary dynamic. And I was listening one day. I fell out of my chair because what I'm hearing is then Secretary of Treasury John Connally has a very distinct drawl, Texas drawl. And he's, pretty famous in these here parts in Texas as our former governor. He was in the
The motorcade.
The fateful Kennedy motorcade, exactly. Yeah, thank you. And so and I had interviewed him as well, Connally, many years ago, so I knew his voice. And Nixon comes into this meeting. He assembles all of his closest aides and says, boys, what are we going to do about this? And he's talking about the potheads, the hopheads. He was referring to Senator Ted Kennedy as a hophead. It seemed like an old-fashioned and even now quaint way to suggest that Kennedy was high as a kite or, smoking pot. And he said, what are we going to do? I'm trying to kick butt in Vietnam. What's the plan? And Connally, in this very distinct Texas drawl, says, well, Mr. President, you have to do kind of what we had done with the mafia, with Carlo Gambino and Lucky Luciano, the really infamous heads of the mafia. We need to identify a public enemy, just somebody whom we could put on a dartboard and declare public enemy, the biggest threat. The thought process was that American voters, American citizens would respond to the demonization of an individual more than sort of an issue or a concept. It would make it easy for people to wrap their hands around. Mm-hmm. And
seems so quaint today, doesn't it? That they're coming up with this idea, an idea that's used time and time again.
I know. And it has certainly happened before, but it was startling to hear it articulated. Yeah. And the funny part to me, I guess it's funny, is that Nixon says, well, who do you got? Yeah. And then somebody just shouts, it's Connally. Connally shouts, well, there's that guy, Leary. And then the whole room, it's about a dozen man, I could just picture the Nixon, you know, soldiers along with Nixon. They basically began chanting Timothy Leary's name. Leary, Leary, Leary. And they were laughing with excitement. It was as if they had discovered the perfect, you know, last-second football play to win the game. And then it ends with Nixon shouting out, well, we've got room in the prisons for him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what had been an unofficial plan to turn Tim Leary into the most dangerous man in America turned into an official plan. And Nixon sent another infamous figure in Watergate annals, Attorney General John Mitchell. He sent him to Europe to try to find Tim, who was on the lam and hiding, and then unleashed the State Department and CIA and the FBI. And the game, the battle, the pursuit was on. And for a while, Tim was, well, Nixon called him the most dangerous man in America and as well the most hunted man in America.
That's the name of the book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. Bill Minutaglio is a journalist and author. He co-wrote the book with Stephen L. Davis. He's joining us from the NPR station KUT in Austin. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUBR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the person Richard Nixon described as the most dangerous man in America, Timothy Leary, who was serving a 10-year prison term for the possession of two marijuana cigarettes when he escaped. And the result is this global manhunt that's chronicled in the book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, written by Bill Minutaglio, who's our guest, along with Stephen L. Davis. And we're talking about the story. It's this 28-month, really strange period in American history. Bill Minutaglio, let me ask you about Timothy Leary, how he comes to become this godfather of the psychedelic movement. Mm. There's this turning point that I wanted to ask you about, you describe in the book, where Leary comes to see himself at Harvard as a middle-aged man involved in the middle-aged process of dying. He's bored, basically. Mm. And just before his 40th birthday, he takes mushrooms. And I guess this was something that kind of changed him. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, radically. He was on you know, a track that I guess a lot of folks would think would be pretty successful. I spent a lot of time in academia, so I know the allure of the track. He was highly educated, had all the right pedigree. He was moving up the food chain and had gotten to Harvard. He was a professor at Harvard, you know, the pinnacle in the 1950s. And he was a, you know, kind of a button-down guy, and he liked drinking martinis and going to those dutiful, you know, parties on weekends with other academics where great ideas would be debated and people would fuss about how to get published in all the right journals and things like that. I'm not besmirching that, all of that, by the way. That's just the world he was in.
Sure.
But he was doing a lot of work in exploring how to heal people who were dealing with mental health issues. Tim was especially interested in holistic, organic, natural remedies. He heard about magic mushrooms, as we call them today. He went down to Mexico, tried some, and he said that the 3 to 4, the few hours that he had spent expanding his consciousness through the use of the magic mushrooms, he learned more in that time period than he had in, you know, 40 years of formal education.
Yeah.
And it did transform him. And he came back to Harvard and said, I want to keep going. I want to keep pushing. I want to keep pushing. And I think it's really important to note that Tim, you know, wasn't an idle recreational drug user, as some people wanted to portray him, particularly Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody out there was a Pied Piper, you know, giving away drugs like candy to children. It, far from it. He was doing very serious, quantifiable research on how, LSD and other powerful psychotropic things would help people. And in particular, he was looking at reducing the rate of recidivism.
Yeah.
Among prisoners, folks who had committed crimes, so that if they were treated in some way, they were habitual criminals. Maybe they wouldn't repeat the crime and go back and continue sort of a vicious cycle. And Tim, though, being eternally curious and interested, but also one of those folks, I think, is in the sense of physician, heal thyself, or the spirit of physician, treat thyself, began trying a lot of the things that he was experimenting with. And the deeper he got into it, the more he felt that he had opened up, in a good way, Pandora's box, and that the chemical, particularly LSD, could lead to mass change. And that if, as you said, more people turned on, that the world would simply be a better place. And he became to view LSD as really a sacrament. One of his first organizations or groups that he helped form after he was spun out of Harvard. Harvard frowned on these experiments, by the way. They were just wondering what was going on with the students, what was happening down at that other end of campus. Yeah. Things seemed to be a little more unusual than they hoped. And so he was spun out of Harvard, but he began doing further research with the support of a lot of friends. I call them seekers, people high and low in terms of financial power, who would fund him or support him and just encourage him. And he called his group the League of Spiritual Discovery. Yeah. Ha ha, you know, LSD. Yep. But it's an indication of his beginning to view LSD as something even beyond a palliative for mental health issues, but that it could affect mass change. He believed it. And that the more people turned on, the better they'd be.
He believed that your essential coding was changed when you took psychedelics, that it really transformed a person.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I love telling this story that I was in Houston, Texas several weeks ago, and I met a gentleman who came up to me and said, you know, I'm the man that shot Timothy Leary's ashes into outer space. And I said, okay, let's chat.
Yeah.
And is that on your business card? And he said, that's a true story, by the way. Tim's ashes were launched into outer space at his request. And the cosmic joke, I think, that emerged from talking to people that knew Tim was that LSD had been so embedded into his molecular core. Tim had done hundreds and hundreds of trips, never seemed to be unhinged, you know, quote unhinged, in the way that people probably expected him to turn into. But the cosmic joke was that as Tim's ashes re-entered Earth's atmosphere, you know, some of us have been breathing Tim's molecules, and in some way we might be ingesting some LSD, and then Tim might have had that mass change effect that he was
hoping
really looking for.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about where he ends up in this California prison. It's a medium security prison. It doesn't seem like it's terribly intense in terms of the maximum security. And as you put it in the book, all the traps, though, at this particular time are snapping down. I mean, aside from the California sentence, he's facing 10 years in Texas, 10 or more in New York.
Yep.
Now, and you believe the idea was, you think, Bill, that the Nixon administration wanted him in prison for the rest of his life, basically?
Unequivocally, I'm convinced of it, and I think the research really backs it up. There was a plan. There was a coordinated plan, and it's just amazing to think about. Coast to coast and all points in between. You mentioned Texas. He had was facing a decade for having a small amount of marijuana crossing the border, you know, from Texas to Mexico. And another infamous figure, you know, the annals of modern smash mouth politics, G. Gordon Liddy, you know, the man behind Watergate, the agent of change in Watergate, had been a New York State prosecutor in the 1960s, before he became more infamous later with Watergate. Mm-hmm. And he had at the top of his list, I need to bust Tim Leary. So there were charges stacked up there. There were charges in Texas, charges in California. And Tim's 50 years old by the time he's sent to prison. And you could do the math that the thought was that now we have him and he'll die in prison.
Yeah. What can we say? And I don't want to give away too much about the actual escape. And we know he did. That's common knowledge at this point. But the story of it's pretty, I have to say, entertaining and remarkable for a 50-year-old man. Right. He had to get in shape to pull this off.
It's you know, in the acknowledgments to our book, I suppose you're normally supposed to begin, you know, thanking your loved ones and all the folks that helped you do research. But we chose to put as our first line in the acknowledgments, thank you to Tim Leary for leading such an interesting life. And I we weren't being churlish or silly. It's just extraordinary because he was 50 years old, and I think one of the most unlikely people to do what he did, to break out of a prison in California that was ringed by 12-foot-high, you know, razor wire, was patrolled by men carrying guns and you know, patrol cars around the outskirt of the prison. Tim was one of the few people in the history of the particular prison he was in to bust out. And then when he broke out in this most dramatic and unlikely way, he really didn't know what was waiting for him in the dark. He really didn't know what was out there. But it turned out that
just
he was
picked. I'm going to step in to say, maybe you're headed there, so sorry. But it seems like this is the point at which, as you say, he did not know who had busted him out, basically. I mean, it turns out it's the weathermen who are, you know, sponsoring the escape, which is a surprise to him. And he doesn't know that much about the weathermen at the time. I mean, they were this kind of violent group. They supported violent revolution, as you talked about earlier. And it seems like it's at this point when he seems to get caught up into something he doesn't have control over, and when he loses, I think, control over the narrative, it seems, at this point.
Yeah, that's really, really well said. He became the cork of the raging river.
Yeah.
And you know, he would just, you know, get sucked under, and then you go, oh, that's it for Tim. And then he'd emerge. He'd just emerge later. Yeah, he's basically hiding in a ditch on the side of a California highway outside of a pretty heavily secured prison. He had been told by his attorneys that somebody might come by in a car, and if the lights flash repeatedly, you should run to that car. I can't relate to that. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
But he did. He hops in the car. He basically says, thanks for picking me up. Who are you people? And as he's asking him this, they're beginning to shave his head. They're beginning to hand him clothes and new identification ultimately. They're basically remaking him on the fly. And, yeah, it's the leaders of the Weather Underground, which were the most active, you know, I think revolutionary group in terms of attacks on institutions, campuses, you know, the man, the establishment in modern American history. And Tim is going, okay, we're off to the races. This could have been the arc, you know, the point in the narrative where he began, even though he was in the moment, he was hovering above it and going, this is so unbelievably existentially absurd. I have to roll with it. I just have to keep rolling with it. And he did, you know, they it seems unlikely today, but they were able to change his identity to such a degree that he was able to escape the United States and then proceed on to an even greater adventure in North Africa.
We'll get to that here in a moment. Let me ask you, let's bring up the thread of the story that involves Richard Nixon, because there are a number of times in this story when Nixon is just losing it. Kissinger is worried about him. And now I think people who know the story of Richard Nixon know all of these stories at this point. But how does he react to the news that Leary has escaped? I mean, he gives this speech at Kansas State University that you write about, where he talks about how these revolutionaries deserve the contempt of every American. So again, he's using Timothy Leary to get it seems like he's just trying to animate his conservative base and distract the country.
Yep. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Now, this is where, you know, again, Nixon's looking down at a big chessboard. He is the president of the United States, and there's a pawn on that chessboard, and its name is Tim Leary. Mm-hmm. And Nixon begins to surround him and then even, you know, reach across the table and begin moving the pawn, even though it's an opposing player, just moving it wherever he wanted. And it just seemed increasingly an indication, to get to Nixon, of his own personal unraveling, becoming more unhinged. He's drinking enormously. And again, these are repertorial observations. They're borne out, you know, by history and historians. It's not that I'm taking, you know, wild swings at Nixon. It's just clear. And the deeper he got into his own personal paranoia and the sense that he was being set upon by the wicked media and anti-war protesters. He was looking really almost out the curtains of the Oval Office and the White House and seeing a nation on fire and against Nixon. The more he was determined to get leery and to, deflect attention away from his own shortcomings, his own problems.
Ends up in Algeria for a time.
right.
And it's interesting. I mean, they were mulling over different options. Where are we gonna take Tim Leary?
Right.
And they were thinking Mexico and maybe South America or Central America. But Leary's ears perk up, you say, when someone mentions Algeria. And explain why. I mean, this was basically – it had become an outpost, you say, for the revolutionary experimentation going on.
Yeah, I think this is, again, heavily biased here, so forgive me. But I think it's a forgotten but great part of interesting, you know, American history. Tim escapes from prison. He's in a car. He learns that he's with the underground. And he goes, what's next? What are you people going to do? Thank you for getting me out of prison now or being here to pick me up. What happens next? And he thought he'd maybe go to a tropical locale, maybe a place with tropical Marxism in a way, if that makes sense.
Yes,
some place
totally.
with a little sangway, kind of a more relaxed environment. And yeah, you said, you know, Mexico, or maybe he'd go to India to hide out. And then the weather underground said, no, we'd rather that you go to Algeria. And Tim, I think, was, you know, gobsmacked. Why Algeria? And they said, well, that's where the Black Panther embassy is. And that had to be explained to Tim. The Algerian government at that time turning somewhere even, you know, beyond socialism toward you know, hardcore politics had decided that the United States was not the Richard Nixon government was not the true representative of the United States, but in fact the Black Panthers were. So in Algeria, you had the Black Panther embassy, and Algerian officials treated the Black Panthers as the authentic representatives of the U.S. Rather amazing. It seems incredibly unlikely, but the idea was let's send Tim there because some Black Panthers were on the lam, most notably, you know, one of the most famous Black Panther leaders, Eldridge Cleaver.
Yeah.
Was headquartered there. He was hiding as well. And so the thought was, well, Tim will go there. And this was the plan. This is where Tim became a pawn, frankly, on the left. The idea was that by Tim meeting and hanging out with Eldridge Cleaver, another hardcore action-oriented revolutionary who wanted to overthrow what he called Babylon, his word for America, that this would really be the final marriage of dope and dynamite. Tim would bring together, as the counterculture leader, would bring together millions of his followers, the hippies, the folks from the Summer of Love, and that he would marry them with the Black Panthers and, by extension, the Weather Underground, and then thus, you know, the mobilization would occur and America would be overthrown. Unfortunately, things didn't quite work out that way. Tim, we argue in the book, was in a way held hostage in Algeria because some of the Panthers thought that Tim wasn't as serious about politics and revolution as they hoped.
As the story plays out, and we don't have time to get into all of this, but I have to say just the stories of the plane rides back to the United States are worth the price of the book. The strange sort of parties that go on. Leary has sex with his girlfriend a couple of times.
Yes.
It's very weird and great. I mean, it seems like such the early 70s, these moments.
Tim, and again, I'm trying to hover above it myself as I look down on this work and looking at Tim. He remained a rather joyous figure. My great, brilliant co-writer, Stephen L. Davis, refers to Tim as a coyote trickster, which is in a nod to the sort of Southwestern tradition of identifying this character who was a sort of a wily, crafty coyote who had the ability to go up into the heavens and steal fire from the gods. You know, that would be LSD, perhaps. But had that ability. He had that ability to go around the yellow police tape of life and just go up to heaven and just get the sacraments, bring them down to earth. But then he would burn his own tail, and he would once in a while burn others, but always in the spirit of adventure, curiosity, and thinking that he was on the right path. Just that a lot of things happened along the way that he didn't account for, and there were a lot of fires that were set. And the greatest thing about him, though, is that he remained buoyant. He did remain like the cork in the raging river that never got submerged. When I met him, he, though puzzled by what had happened, he remained, upbeat about possibilities. He was also, by the way, very worried, you know, later in life that people would identify him only as, you know, the father of LSD. And he was multifaceted in looking at a lot of different things, how we communicate, how we get along, and but he really did lead a very interesting life.
It's interesting. He does end up back in prison. In prison for 17 months, and he gets this visit from the FBI and federal prosecutors.
Right.
And basically, they want him to give up these radical groups that he's been associating with, the Weather Underground, as you mentioned, the Black Panthers, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which is a great sort of part of the story. We don't have time to get into. It's great, by the way. But you say in the book that Leary, he had been meditating on this idea at the time of telling the truth and the idea of paranoia. I mean, he's, of course, seeing Nixon unraveling and he's paying attention to all of this. Watergate is just about to undo Richard Nixon. And he has this insight about secrecy being the original sin, that concealment is the seed source of every human conflict. And so he agrees to, I don't know if he betrays the underground or these radicals, but would you just talk about this moment? Because I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah, thank you, by the way, for describing that so aptly and reading it so closely, the work. Tim was under duress. I'm soft selling it that way. I mean, from the early 1960s straight through 1973, he was being pursued by the most aggressive law enforcement agencies and ultimately the White House, and you know, just hounded. And people wanted pieces of him. Everybody did, left and right. And he came to a point where he was facing – again, the same thing that he was facing before he busted out of prison. He was back in jail, back in Folsom Prison, and it looked like he was going to be there forever, and he was going to die. And this is a man who just loved being out there and trying to be influential, and he did enjoy some of the acclaim. And he basically, decided that he needed to not help the FBI, but probably affirm what Tim believed they already knew. Yeah. So he was being heavily, heavily interrogated. He really wanted to get out of prison. And Tim's story is that he gave up a lot of names, but there were ones that he was quite certain, you know, the FBI and officials had already had. They seemed satisfied, and ultimately he was let go. It did create a bit of a schism.
Yeah.
The folks on the left said, wow, he sold us out. He was a narc.
Yep. A snitch.
And we can't trust him anymore. But there are many, many people to this day. I hear from them all the time, from around the world, by the way, who still really believe in Tim, and that he gave their argument is that he gave to the government the truth that they already had.
Yeah. We're essentially out of time, but let me ask you one more question.
Yeah.
What do you make of Timothy Leary's legacy, finally, as you assess it? I mean, there were, you know, moments where he made mistakes. Toward the end, you write beautifully about how he's starting to think differently about embracing the idea of death. Of course, he's diagnosed with inoperable prostate cancer. So where does he end up in terms of his legacy? And now, I mean, how do we think about Timothy Leary these days?
It's a great question. Again, I really think that you could take it from both a macro and a micro perspective, like a street level perspective. the changes that people are seeing in states around the country, the relaxation and normalization of marijuana laws, I can connect dots. And I'll wrestle anybody about this theory to prove that I'm right. Tim Leary was responsible for the changes that we're experiencing today in terms of drug use and particularly marijuana. There's a portion of the book where he was advocating 30, 40 years ago, the very things that are being enacted today. So there's that. That's part of his legacy, this revisitation. By the way, there are a lot of people talking about microdosing, doing small amounts of LSD to improve creativity in Silicon Valley and just, you know, high-tech startups and so on. So there's that. I think he eased the minds of people that were really afraid of this, you know, demon drug. But then beyond that, I was saying to some folks the other day, to quote, I think it was Elvis Costello's song, you know, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Tim, that's what he was all about. Why not consider that and consider it seriously? Maybe there are paths to it through LSD, and maybe there are other ways, but choose your own major is what he would tell you.
Bill Minitalio. He, in along with Stephen L. Davis, is the author of the book The Most Dangerous Man in America, Timothy Leary, Richard Nixon, and the Hunt for the Fugitive King of LSD. He joined us from the radio station KUT in Austin. Bill, thanks very much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. This is a great, great conversation. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The program was directed today by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.